It's the confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Several hundred additional students will be getting a hands-on learning experience of our rivers and aquatic life because Rivers of Steel is expanding the scope of the highly acclaimed RiverQuest program. Joining us in studio is Augie Carlino, president and CEO of Rivers of Steel National Heritage Area. Welcome, Augie. Good to have you here.
Thank you for having me. Good morning.
Augie, remind us, Rivers of Steel National Heritage Area was created 1996 by Congress, that official designation. Much of the focus is on our steel heritage, but it's certainly not limited to steel.
Not limited to steel. It involves other industries that supported the steel industry, and it also looks at transportation networks, and the rivers were key to that. So it's a big area, southwest Pennsylvania, 8 counties that we cover.
So was that the initial mission, or did the mission grow through the years?
Well, what grew was the geographic scope of the heritage area. When it first started, it was only focused on Allegheny and Washington County. But as we worked with the National Park Service and other historians, what came into view was the huge expanse of the industrial network in southwest Pennsylvania. And as important as the mills here in the city were, they were all supported by outlying industries. And so that's how we expanded the scope and the programming for the heritage area.
And 8 counties now?
8 counties, yeah. Allegheny, Armstrong, Washington, Westmoreland, Beaver, Butler, Fayette, Green, and Washington.
Mm-hmm.
Did I get all 8?
I think you did. And he didn't cheat. He didn't look. But you're not just preserving or focusing on preservation. You are honoring it and acknowledging it so the people remember it. You're also involved in the present and the future of the region as well.
Well, you know, preservation gets a bad rap because a lot of times people believe that if something is going to be preserved, it's going to stifle development. Mm. Our goal was to use the history and the heritage and the culture of southwest Pennsylvania as a building block to the future for southwest Pennsylvania's communities. And so that's what we do. We're organized as a community development organization. We just happen to work on heritage, history, and preservation. That's one of the goals that we have. But we also do a lot with education. We do a lot with riverfront redevelopment. We do a lot in Main Street communities. And, you know, it's a very broad organization in its scope and its mission.
A key part of that future are our young people, our students. And you wanted to get more students involved in the region to get that firsthand experience in learning about our rivers. First of all, how did Rivers of Steel sort of absorb and take over the RiverQuest program? Why did you want to do that? Then I want to get into that expansion.
Yeah, good question. Well, we have always been partners with RiverQuest, even from the day they started. One of the things that we do as a National Heritage Area is provide grants to partner organizations, funding that we get from either the state or the federal government. We're able to re-grant. So we were working with RiverQuest. We helped them build their docks over on the North Shore at the Carnegie Science Center. We were doing programming with them. And then one day in, I think it was 2014, I read in the newspaper that they were looking for a merger partner or they were going to go out of business. You know, the economic recession had hit them hard, and the cutbacks on education programming at the state level took away a lot of the funding for schools to put kids on the boat. It just seemed to be too important of a program and project to Pittsburgh and southwest Pennsylvania to be allowed to be lost. And I made a phone call. I wasn't sure if we were going to be that merger partner, but I figured at the very least as a partner, we should reach out, extend a hand, see if we could help. And after about 2.5 years of negotiations, a massive business plan that looked at completely restructuring how RiverQuest worked, we took them over in 2016.
Mm-hmm. What is the idea behind RiverQuest at its core?
At its core, it's looking at environmental life of the rivers. So many people still believe that our river quality and the waters in our rivers are highly polluted, toxic, and support no life. So fundamentally, kids will be learning about environmental sciences and water ecology when they get on the boat through a STEM education program. So it's to entice them to maybe go on to learning about science, engineering, other types of scientific curriculums when they go on through college. But what we add to that now is the history behind the environmental reclamation of the rivers and what kids come away learning. In fact, everybody does, whether it's our STEM education programs or our Pittsburgh 101 tours that we're doing, where we talk about the advance of Pittsburgh as a technologically driven city. What they're coming to learn is the rivers are so important to the vibrancy and the quality of life of Southwest Pennsylvania.
Okay. So the kids get on the boat. It's not just going for a little cruise on the river and hearing a lecture.
No.
I mentioned a couple times, hands-on. So what do they do, not just listen to?
Well, they're doing water quality experiments. They're actually taking samples out of the riverbed. They're taking samples out of the water. They're challenged to find certain types of organisms that live in the water. They do scientific experiments with microscopes. They're working with teachers. We have a full crew of not only boat crew, but we have a full crew of teachers that actually teach them a STEM environmental education program when they're on the boat. This is not, as much as it's a day excursion for these kids, this is not a day where they're going out and not learning. They are actually involved in a curriculum. And in advance of that program, that day on the boat, they are getting a lot of information that comes to the classroom prior to in order to prepare them for that day on the boat. So it's a heavily involved learning program for them.
So thousands of students have participated in this through the years, but you wanted to expand it. Why and to where?
Well, what we saw was the opportunity, as I said, to build history and heritage into the program. What many kids didn't understand is what the rivers were like that caused the environmental degradation to them during the industrial height of the region. So we bring that history to it. And we're not there to basically knock that industry. They're to talk about how the region has worked as it's transformed in order to clean its environment up. What we've also done is put the kids through other types of learning opportunities. They get involved. And we built a Pittsburgh 101 tour where the general public gets involved now as part of the programming.
But the kids in the sort of the southern counties of your eight counties didn't have an opportunity, really, well, because of distance?
Yeah, well, they did. But, you know, imagine a child getting on a bus in order to be at a boat at the Science Center at 9:30 in the morning. If that child's coming from, say, maybe Washington, PA or Uniontown, he or she has to get on that school bus extremely early. They spend many hours on the bus. They get to our boat, and normally the program is about 4.5 hours long. Right now, because they spend so much time on the bus and so much time having to get home, that curriculum day is condensed. We saw as an opportunity to get the boat upriver and take it to the Mid-Mon and then be able to use those landing areas up in the Mid-Mon in order to get those Mid-Mon Valley school districts more involved. It gives the child more time on the boat so she and he learns a whole lot more. It reduces the transportation costs for the school district, so it makes the whole day more affordable for the schools and the parents that are paying. And the other thing it does, it completely changes the setting for the environmental programming. So instead of learning about water quality at the point, we're now learning and teaching about water quality in other parts of the tributaries in the river system. The Mid-Mon River has a completely different water quality system and setup than what maybe you would find at the point. Mm-hmm. And kids get to experience that and learn that. And it's right in the place where they live.
Yes. And so we have maybe some different scientific results, different learning experiences as well.
Correct. You know, you've got a lot more issues related to maybe active mines and acid mine drainage. We've got a lot of issues related to the extraction industry that's going on up there and what effects, positive and negative, that might have on the river and the water quality of that area. And like I said, just from the standpoint of history and heritage, the Mid-Mon is completely different from an industrial history than the areas around Pittsburgh.
And by the way, I'd be remiss if I didn't mention the boat, the Explorer, is really neat. I believe it's the first vessel in the world to have LEED standards applied to its entire engineering and construction.
That is correct. It runs like a Prius. You know, it's got a diesel system of motors and generators, and those generators, when the diesel's running, it is generating batteries. We can run at times completely silent off of the electric engines and motors that we have.
It fits into the whole learning experience,
I guess.
It does.
And it's an amazing boat. When we took it over, the boat was retrofitted prior to the takeover to rebuild a lot of those engines. After the fact, we put a whole lot more money into it. It's now not just green, but it's far more high tech than it was when we took it over.
We have less than 2 minutes left. I wanted to get to something else. The value of heritage tourism. You talked about Pittsburgh 101, is it?
Correct.
Okay. The value of that tourism to the region, is that intended for out-of-town visitors, residents, whom?
Both. You know, we have to become ambassadors of our own places that we live in. And if we have a negative view of our city and our region, it's hard to make people excited about maybe wanting to live here. We saw that 30 years ago when Rivers of Steel started and the industrial decline. It was hard to get people excited about their history and heritage. But the more we talked about what this region did and the more we talked about Pittsburgh as a city and a region that's always been on the vanguard of technological advancement, people became more and more interested and more excited about their communities. So what we do in heritage tourism is we use monies that we're able to get in order to help conserve important places in those communities. And then those places become destinations. You see that on trails, for example. And as we helped put money into the trail building, a lot of old industrial communities suddenly sprung to life as trailhead communities that now support bed and breakfasts and cafes and other types of shops. You're seeing that in some communities in the Mid-Mon Valley with arts programming and the reach of our Mon Valley Creative Corridor program, where we're working with different artists in order to help get them embedded into communities. So heritage is an important component to rebuilding communities.
Augie Carlino is the president and CEO of Rivers of Steel National Heritage Area. Augie, thanks so much for coming by.
Thank you, Kevin. I appreciate the opportunity.
I'm Megan Harris. The Confluence airs live from 9 to 10 a.m., but the news never stops. Find more stories, conversations, and more on our website at wesa.fm/confluence, on Twitter at WESAConfluence, and wherever you get your podcasts. The Confluence continues next on 90.5 WESA.
I'm Katie Blackley with the Pittsburgh Almanac. This week in history, Soldiers and Sailors Memorial Hall and Museum opens in 1910. The Oakland building is the largest memorial in the country dedicated to military veterans. It was designed by a group of Civil War servicemen in the 1890s who enlisted architect Henry Hornbostel to create the Beaux-Arts structure. It served as host for many famous visitors, including Barack Obama and Nelson Mandela, and has a museum that honors more than 600 veterans. That's today's Pittsburgh Almanac for October 8th, 2018.
WESA celebrates 90 neighborhoods, 90 good stories, a weekly series about people who make the place they live a better place to live. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
It's the Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Drafting Dreams is a Homewood-based program that teaches Pittsburgh area K through 12 students the principles of architecture and urban design. Its founder is Christian Hughes, who tells 90.5 WESA's Elaine Effort that the goal is to get more minorities and girls interested in the architecture field.
What do you want them to take a critical look at?
Always want them to critically assess neighborhood strengths regarding Main Street corridors, and also look at where some opportunities for improvement can be and how architecture can serve as a solution for those opportunities.
Are the students sort of intimidated by drafting and math and design? How do you pull them in?
It is such a mix. You know, you always have the student that anything with math, they're here for it. You have the one that maybe picks a part of it and say, math is not my strong suit, don't want to do this. And so the way that we kind of rope them in is, one, just through our interpersonal connection with them, a little bit of relationship building on the front end to encourage them and get them to understand that architecture is not just this one component that you may not be so strong at. Most students really get over those fears once we begin to get them in the software and they get the chance to really shape something that could potentially be their reality. Then they get all excited and forget, a couple minutes ago I was spazzing out about not knowing math or et cetera.
Because they feel empowered once they know about you have to factor in zoning and all the issues, but that they get to create.
We really, really want to focus on the creativity side, because once we give them these technical skills to allow them to be creative, then it's off to the races from there.
So you're seeing results already?
Already. We have, since our first project series in 2016, engaged 560 or so students. We have maybe a handful of students who are in the process of applying to colleges for architecture, or are looking into applying to colleges once they get of that age. And we also maybe have two or three that are currently enrolled in university studying architecture.
How satisfied are you with the program Drafting Dreams?
I am satisfied to the tune that it is fulfilling the mission that it has been called to fulfill. But as an entrepreneur, as an innovator, as someone who really is out here for the community, if you will, there's a level of comfortability that I tend to not fall into. Because for me, it's about constantly innovating, constantly pivoting. So I'm satisfied that Drafting Dreams is meeting the mission, that it's doing the work that we say we do. But I try not to get too comfortable in how well we do it so that I can always continue improving, always open for different ways of doing things.
Christian Hughes, local architect in training and founder of Drafting Dreams, thank you for taking time to do this interview.
Thank you so much. I'm honored to even be interviewed.
Who's making a difference in your neighborhood? Share your suggestion for our series WESA Celebrates 90 Neighborhoods, 90 Good Stories at WESA.FM/90. Made possible with support from UPMC, life-changing medicine.
This is The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. It's The Confluence on 90.5 WESA. I'm Kevin Gavin. Life after dark takes many forms. To address challenges in a city's nighttime economy, some cities are turning to night mayors, or in Pittsburgh's case, a night economy manager. Joining us in studio is Allison Harnden, who's held that position for about 3 years. Allison, welcome to the program.
Hi, Kevin. Thanks for having me here.
All right. So we have established that some cities have night mayors. We have a manager, you. Break it down for us. What is the difference?
Well, you heard the story about the night mayor in Amsterdam.
Hey, folks. Producer Megan Harris here. In the original live broadcast of Monday's episode of The Confluence, we included a 7-minute piece about challenges facing Amsterdam's nightmare. That story mentioned Pittsburgh as one of a dozen or more cities around the world with a nightmare, or like the Steel City, a nighttime economy manager. It went on about successes and challenges regarding tourism and what it takes to effectively liaise between business owners, residents, and the patrons of nighttime establishments. Unfortunately, that story also featured samples of several songs WESA doesn't have the rights to share in this format. But you can find it linked on our website, WESA.FM, and on theirs at NPR.org. Host Kevin Gavin's conversation with Pittsburgh nighttime economy manager Allison Harnden continues now.
What is the difference?
Well, you heard the story about the nightmare in Amsterdam. There, a lot of the ones in Europe come from, they actually operate outside city government. There's only a handful of nightmares and managers in the U.S., really less than 10. And I organize a quarterly call with those managers. We share information. So I have a pretty good idea of what their construct is like. There's a few of them that are in a business improvement district. There are some that are in redevelopment authority. San Francisco has kind of a split between their Entertainment Commission and the Economic Development Department. And New York just created an entertainment, or I'm sorry, a nightlife commission. Mm-hmm. So I think a very unique model, too, is Tampa's, where they have, it's in the city manager's office, but they have underneath that night manager, someone from the police department, the planning department, the fire department, and all the various departments that would touch on nighttime economy. And here, mine is located in the public safety department.
Okay. So there is a difference from Europe to the U.S., but also differences from U.S. city to U.S.
Yeah,
city.
Yeah, for sure. What we do here in Pittsburgh is the Office of Nighttime Economy is a liaison between nightlife businesses, the communities in which they operate or plan to operate, and all the different departments that touch on nighttime economy. And part of my job is to help position the city as a city that operates at night. We have a lot of night workers. We have 80,000 students in the region. We have medical, info technology, logistics like FedEx and Amazon delivery centers. So we have a lot of people that operate around the clock. So we're becoming more of a life at night city than nightlife. So helping our city departments also adjust to that transition is my role.
Is there a particular reason why your position is within the public safety department?
I don't know that. That happened before I came here. But actually, it's well positioned in some ways. I mean, because economic development goes hand in hand with public safety. Before I came to this role, I was a consultant in nighttime economy since 1995, starting in San Diego, and worked with 26 states and over 50 cities. What I've learned is that, you know, it takes a lot of people, a lot of partners to make that happen. Mm-hmm. So we have that here in Pittsburgh.
Well, how do you get involved in more than the, we'll say, night-to-night situation, making sure that it is a thriving atmosphere, but also a safe atmosphere for people, but also maybe the longer-range thing, mm-hmm. the policy-making, mm-hmm. whether it's working with the state, working with the city, and working with the businesses.
That's right. There's a whole variety of things that need to happen, you know, just sitting down with a new business and helping them get on the right track from the very beginning so that they're operating in a way that supports the nighttime economy and that they're successful, but then reduces the impacts to neighbors. We just created a new guide for food and beverage businesses that helps that. Then on the other end of the spectrum, you know, I'm meeting actually the day after tomorrow in Harrisburg with the PLCB to talk about some of this long range ideas about how nightlife clusters and what that might mean for policy reform at the state level. excuse me. But yes, and then, you know, looking at our various codes. We're a very old city here in Pittsburgh, and things have just kind of stuck in that code for a while, and you go back and go, oh, wow, we don't have this, or we need to change, you know, we didn't have food truck ordinance until recently. So right. Sometimes trends make that pop up. So part of my job, too, is keeping a finger on those trends. I do that through observation out in the citywide, contrary to popular belief. I'm not just working on the south side. I work all over the city. And that helps us come up with, you know, because nightlife tends to move. Well, that's one thing I've learned over the years, that it will move from one neighborhood. And it's happened here in Pittsburgh many times. And now it's sort of spreading out, and so that we have more nightlife nodes instead of big concentrations, although we still have a couple of those.
Are there pros and cons to that spreading out because mm-hmm. it's more accessible to more people? They don't have to go to one neighborhood, one place, right. So it makes it more convenient. But maybe does it make your job a little more challenging?
I don't think so. I think it actually tends to it's better if it spreads out. It also creates... One thing I learned from working in San Diego, I worked with 21 business improvement districts in San Diego. About 8 to 10 of them had some nightlife orientation, but they were all had variances. You know, in one neighborhood, it was earlier evening or more late night in one area, or maybe it's entertainment in one area or more dining or cafe in another. So I think by spreading it out in different nodes, we certainly are able to serve the neighborhoods better, but also to create little niches, you know, of what that life at night is like for that neighborhood.
All right. People have heard you say you go out, you observe. So what are your normal work hours?
Contrary to popular belief, I'm not out partying every weekend. You know, we do have to.
But it's work-related, that partying,
it
right?
It is, yeah. No, I don't. I draw the line at certain things while I'm working. But you have to go out and actually observe it. You can't rely on, you know, secondhand accounts of what's actually happening out there. So, you know, I observe mostly the public space, honestly, but you can also, I do sometimes go into establishments, but I don't, not like the Nightmare of Amsterdam, I don't like to parade around with a purple hat and an earring. You know, I'm trying to be a little more blend in and just observe. But my normal operating hours are, we do have a lot to work out. And the people we're working those things out with are on the day hour shift. So we're flexible. We work nights, weekends. We do community meetings in the evening with residents. So, you know, we're very flexible.
You mentioned San Diego earlier. I believe, I want to know, how did you get started in this field? And I believe you came to Pittsburgh from Las Vegas.
That's right.
Some would say that is the mecca of nighttime entertainment.
Yeah. Ironically, I didn't do much work in Vegas until the last year that I was there. It was just a home base. My husband's a professional musician, and so he was living in Vegas, and we, you know, we lived there. But I started out in the industry, in the hospitality industry, since high school. It helped fund my undergrad and college and graduate school education, and I learned a lot from it. I became a paralegal, and then I was asked to, I was doing some freelance writing because I was looking to shift gears, and I was asked to do a piece on nightlife businesses and and to help put the rules and regulations into lay language, and that was with the Responsible Hospitality Institute. So I ended up working for them for 17 years, and that first contract was with the City of San Diego's Economic Development Department.
How do you bring everybody to the table? Because you are dealing with residents who live in the community. You're dealing with businesses who want to be successful, and you're dealing with patrons who want to have a good time. How do you bring everybody to the table?
You know, I learned a lot from being a consultant. When we first started working and bringing people together in these nightlife districts in different cities, we realized that they all have a different language, and there are a lot of hot button topics, and that sometimes it's better to talk to people in their own group and get to understand their needs and before you actually bring them together with another cohort. So I kind of separate those out into hospitality, development, community, and safety.
Mm-hmm. So in any of those that you just listed, what sorts of problems, maybe challenges, even concerns, have you been able to address so far? You mentioned you've been here about 3 years.
Mm-hmm. Well, one thing that's happened with the South Side is that all over Pittsburgh, there are communities that have business improvement districts or community development corporations, and Southside has neither one of those. So the market started really driving a lot of where the direction went for nighttime economy. So we've put a lot of thought and recommendations, taken recommendations to help get more balance back there. So one of the things that we did was create a parking enhancement district. And I get calls from all over the country saying, you know, asking about that model. What we did, and it was not very popular when it first started, is that on Friday and Saturday night on the South Side, we extend the parking meter revenue collection time to midnight. That money is sequestered, and then it's in a trust fund that goes back right back into that area, just really like a business improvement district. So right now, that started in 2017, And we have over $300,000 in that fund. And only just now are we able to spend those monies and really starting to see a difference. We've installed a bunch of police cameras. There's some police training that's going to happen with businesses and their door security. And we hired a clean team from the Downtown Partnership and the Block by Block that comes, a two-person team. They've collected in just 3 weeks, they've moved something like just under a ton of litter and garbage bags. They've removed weeds from 127 block faces. So they're really making an impact. There's something called the broken windows theory, where if you're not taking care of an area, people think they're just they kind of just go off and behave badly. So while keeping it clean, it's also keeping it safe.
All right. We have just a couple minutes left. I want to get a couple more questions in. So any limitations to what you can accomplish as manager? I mean, you're a city employee, public safety department. You can't really be an advocate except for what? So what are the limitations?
Right. Well, you know, I don't do this work in a vacuum. And the partners that I work with, I'm just highlighting those resources and connecting them. So, you know, I have to rely on them to get there was only me for the first 2 years. And last year I've had another person. I think if we had there's a lot, you know, I haven't talked about in terms of like streetscape development and things like that. We're also informing the way mobility happens in the future. There's a lot of topics that we're working with. So, it's a lot to accomplish, but we like to highlight what other people are doing and bring those resources to the fore. There's a training that PAR does, Pittsburgh Action Against Rape.
Right.
That's for bartenders and teaches them how to recognize predatory behavior and intervene. So there's a lot of work that people are being done, and I'm just a connector for that.
All right, Allison, we have about 30 seconds left. Favorite part of the job?
Oh, just the variety, you know, and the variety of people I get to work with, the variety of tasks I get to do. I'm really excited next year. I'm going to work on looking at socializing as a part of mental well-being. And so that we're going to really start looking at who's isolated and how can we bring more socializing to all ages, lifestyles, and cultures in Pittsburgh. That's our vision.
All right. And real quick, what about young people involving them underage or under 21?
We're working with Oakland right now on a 100 things to do in Pittsburgh before you graduate. And that could be anything for anybody. You don't have to be a student, but we're doing an Instagram account. So you can look for that in the future.
Very good. Allison Harnden is Pittsburgh's Night Economy Manager. Allison, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you, Kevin.
And for today, that is the Confluence where the news comes together on 90.5 WESA. On our next program, we'll meet the millennial mayors, four young chief executives taking charge to revitalize their communities. And what's the likelihood of a jury being brought in for the homicide trial of Michael Rosfeld in the shooting death of Antoine Rose? Today's program was engineered and produced by Kylie Kaczynski, production assistance from Mick Stanelli. The producer of The Confluence is Megan Harris. I'm Kevin Gavin. Until next time, hope you have a good day of good news.